The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with an article from the Reader's Digest titled Letters from the Front. A collection of war letters from the revolution to Iraq helps us all share in the powerful dreams and fears of our soldiers and their loved ones. And there's a picture of a box here with some photographs. It's an old suit. Actually, it's an old suitcase. Remember the old cloth-covered suitcases with the stripes down the sides and the strange handle? Some of the 150,000 letters that scholar Andrew Carroll has gathered since he was a teenager. Interesting. Hang on a second. Having a little trouble with the page here. Okay, got it. When Andrew Carroll's family home in Washington, D.C. burned down in 1989, no one was hurt, thank God. But Carroll, then a sophomore in college, lost everything, including valuable letters from a friend who had witnessed the Tiananmen Square massacre in China. A distant cousin, James Carroll Jordan, heard of the conflagration and called to check in. Carroll explained that everything had been lost, including those letters which he recognized had historical relevance. Funny you should say that, Jordan replied. I was just going through my old World War II footlocker, and I came across a letter I wrote to my wife in 1945. He mailed Carroll the letter, and what Carroll read changed his life. And there's a picture of Mr. Carroll here. He's sitting here in what's like a library. He's got glasses. He's got kind of a high forehead, and I guess his hair is receding somewhat. Looks like he's probably in his 40s. Jordan was 23 and serving in Europe, though the war was pretty much over. General Dwight D. Eisenhower had just ordered nearby troops, including Jordan's platoon, to enter a recently liberated concentration camp. Ike knew there'd come a day when people would say, it didn't happen. It wasn't that bad, Carroll, now 51, says. He wanted eyewitnesses. Upon his return from the camp, Jordan wrote an explicitly detailed 3-page typewritten letter about what he witnessed in Buchenwald. Dear Betty Ann, I saw something today that makes me realize that we're over here fighting this war. It began, we visited a German political internment camp. When we first walked in, we saw all these creatures that were supposed to be men. They were dressed in black and white suits, head shaved, and starving to death. He mentioned a monument that boasted of 51,000 deaths there in just 3 years. They were proud of it. He describes a rapid order, the building where they infected these people with disease, the torture department, the 8 crematory furnaces. He goes on. There's another place I never told you about, the latrine. I won't tell you about it because you won't believe me. It's unbelievable. More than 40 years after Jordan recorded what he saw, his cousin was profoundly moved. I was overwhelmed by the power of the letter, Carroll says. When he called Jordan about sending it back, what Jordan surprised him. Keep it, he told Carroll. I probably would have thrown it away anyway. That statement shot Carroll into action. He has spent almost 30 years since then collecting the approximately 150,000 letters that comprise the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University in Orange, California. Many of the letters have come from the spouses of dead soldiers who entrusted Carroll with their personal artifacts because they feared their own children or grandchildren would simply toss them out. Others were discovered by accident in old barns, renovated homes, garbage bins, and flea markets. They cover every major American war and battle, including Gettysburg and Pearl Harbor, and an equally wide array of topics. Some are routine, asking after Aunt Letty or the farm. Others reveal raw emotion and about lost time and mortality. We have so many letters of fathers writing to the newborn children, says Carroll. The explicit message is, in case I don't come home, know that your father loves you. Such letters, he says, remind us that America's soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines also happen to be someone's child or parent. They're not just statistics to go off to war. Still, imbued in many of these letters is a fervent love of country. One of the oldest in the collection dates back to the American Revolution. Its author, Alexander Scammell, explains to a friend why the war against the crown must be pursued. The prose is eloquent and the flowery befitting the era in which it was written, but the substance is patriotism at its best. My friend, tranny, and oppression wield their iron rod over our country. They begin to shake the very foundation of our Constitution. Whilst the voice of our forefathers' blood cries to us from the ground to define the rights, the liberty, and the territory which they so dearly purchased by their crimson gore and treasure. Every man of true honor and virtue will rather contend for the honor of first spilling his blood in so glorious a cause. Yours, Alexander Scammell. A few years later, in the Battle of Yorktown, Scammell did indeed spill his blood for the cause he held so dear. Filled with misspellings and a shocking observation about President Abraham Lincoln, this letter was written by a wife of a Confederate soldier on Valentine's Day in 1863. It was taken off his body at the Battle of Chancellorsville by a Union soldier. My dear husband, I thought would I write you a few lines to let you know how we all are. I hope these few lines will find you well. I hope you won't get your feet froze, because if you do, the doctor will try to take them off. I wish there never had been a lost war party and old Abe Lincoln hadn't died before he had took his seat as president. Oh, do try and take care of yourself, so that you will live to come home when I write this letter. I can't help but cry thinking of you. I've got the likeness, I hear the daguerreotype, framed this winter, and I've got that to look at. If I ain't got you, but that don't satisfy me, for I would rather have you look at me write as soon as you get this letter. No more at present. Write and let me know how you're getting along. Sarah. World War I, dated October 20th to 1918, 3 weeks before Armistice Day. This letter was written by a young lieutenant to his wife. He's in an Italian hospital for an ailment that's never discussed, but he does mention a new friend who will become a household name in just a few years. Dearest sweetheart, I was very, very wicked this afternoon and went to the horse races. They were jockey races and quite exciting. All of the highest and mightiest in Milan were there. Being officers, we walked in as free as we do into many other places. It's very convenient in these days to be in uniform, especially of a foreign nation. I went out with a Red Cross lieutenant named Hemingway, who comes from Oak Park, by the way. He lives over in the same street Kathy Wright did. He has been here in the hospital 4 months and has some time to go yet. He was out in the trenches one night when a trench mortar shell blew their cover away and let them exposed to machine gun fire. He got 247 wounds from the mortar shell and machine guns. He has a couple pounds of metal they have carved out of him. Lucky he got most of it in his legs and not in a vital spot. Your buddy. World War II. As this young lieutenant lay dying in a Japanese prison camp, he managed to scrawl some words on the back of two small photographs of his family and hand them to a fellow POW who delivered them to his parents after the war. Mommy and Dad. It's pretty hard to check out this way, without a fighting chance. But we can't live forever. I'm not afraid to die. I just hate the thought of not seeing you again. Buy Turkey Ranch with my money, and just think of me often while you're there. Make liberal donations to both sisters. See that Barry has a car as his first year. I guess you can tell Patty that fate just didn't want us to be together. Hold a nice service for me, and put a headstone in my cemetery. Take care of my nieces and nephews. Don't let them ever want anything as I want even warmth or water now. Loving and waiting for you in the world, in the world beyond. Your son, Lieutenant Tommy Kennedy. A staff sergeant borrowed a pen to note. A year ago today, I was sweating out shells in Anzio Beachhead, he wrote. Today, I'm sitting in Hitler's luxurious furnished apartment in Munich. What a contrast. World War II. Many soldiers worried less about battlefield than they did about home front. This soldier, writing from somewhere in North Africa in 1943, overtly and covertly asked his girl back home if she still loves him. Dear Dot, did you ever receive the perfume that I sent you? A tent mate sent some home after I did, and he has just received a letter acknowledging it. Perhaps you have too, but it might be another batch of letters that are taking a long time to get to me. Some letters ago, I told you about the reactions of some of the men to the news they received from home. It still keeps on happening and turns some of the boys into men. When the test comes, these will be the men who feel that they have very little to lose and will become either heroes or dead men. This, my darling, is another one of those letters that started as an exercise in two-finger typing and became lost somewhere. I seem to hear you say, don't be afraid, I'll always understand. You always have. So I keep pouring my petty troubles in your ears. For me, there is only one hope left, that at the end of my journey you will be there to welcome me. All the love, darling, that I haven't been able to give you for these many months has been choked up in my heart. Tonight, I must tell you, you are the ship that will carry me safely home, the armor that will shield me from harm, and the breath that comes into my body. Every wonderful African sunrise is the light that shines from your eyes, and every sunset the curve of your lips. The lapping of the waves upon the shore was your voice whispering to me. There is nothing that is good and kind that crosses my path that doesn't make me think of you. I'm hungry and thirsty. I'm tired and I'm weary. I'm savage and beastly. I'm all that is wretched, only because we are apart. You have created storms in the breast whose fury, if unfocused, if unloosed, would have torn us both apart. I loved you even when I thought I hated. I'm just trying to say what has been said a million times before by poets and singers and said so much better. Sweetheart, I love you, Bill. Dot felt the same way Bill did. They married soon after he returned home. Forgive me if I sound a little choked up occasionally on this. As a combat veteran of Vietnam, I've been there. Korean War. This letter was found in the waste paper basket in a bank near the safe deposit boxes. The writer Paul is addressing his dearest wife and family from his hospital bed in Japan. He was wounded in the thigh by a sniper's bullet during a fierce firefight with Chinese troops that saw many American casualties, including some who were wounded while helping Paul to a shelter in a ditch. Because he couldn't walk, the surviving Americans went off for help. Not long after, he saw some guys walking against the dim light of the sky. I yelled for help, and they started towards me. They had long, fixed bayonets. They were Chinese soldiers. They squatted and stood around and looked at me for a while, but did not harm me or abuse me. In fact, I saw an honest look of pity and sympathy on every face. I knew then that they would not leave me there to freeze and die. They took me by the hands and tied a belt around my feet and dragged me for about a mile to a small burned-out village. Then a Chinese medic came and put a fresh bandage on my leg and put me on a litter. I was carried into one house that was left standing, where they made a warm fire and covered me up as best they could. I'm sure what they did for me saved my life. Our 1st and 2nd battalions were coming through, and the Chinese had to leave. I opened the door and yelled for help. The Americans heard me, and they found me. I thanked God. I love you, and have an idea that I will be seeing you soon. P.S. What's left of the squad would still like to have your cookies. Iraq War. Service members often refer to one another using call signs, essentially nicknames inspired by the physical characteristics of personality trait, or in the case of 2nd Lieutenant Barber Heine de Mircea, a single unfortunate incident that draws the attention of the chain of command, in this case a few U.S. Secretary of Defense. We were trudging over to the Combat Operations Center. General Mattis, as the commanding general of the entire 1st Marine Division, had his back to the entrance. I was heading through the passageway when I felt myself slip. Almost in slow motion, I thought, no, as I tumbled, head first, into his butt. Yes, my head, his butt. And every time I see him, I blush, and he smiles, thinking, I'm sure, yep, that's the girl. Love, Heine. I wonder why they skipped the Vietnam War in this one. The Iraq War. This email from Stephen Weber, a Marine serving in Iraq in 2004, was sent to his friends at St. Louis University, a Jesuit college in Missouri. Over Christmas, my infantry battalion was activated, and instead of going back to school, I'm spending the spring in Iraq. I'm between Fallujah and Baghdad in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. These are random observations from my war. It's not complete. It will probably all change tomorrow. Forgive me if it's not organized. Living in the land of insanity makes it difficult to be coherent. Amen to that. 20-some Iraqis were killed here yesterday by mortars at about 2 in the afternoon. The rounds landed about 650 feet from me. Today their relatives found out the names of the dead. Carol recalls Weber later telling him that he never did find out who fired the mortar. I sleep in a prison cell, literally. It was part of Saddam Hussein's most notorious torture center. I ate breakfast where he killed 30,000 Iraqis over the last 10 years. Yesterday, a kid, who couldn't have been older than 4, pointed a stick at me like a rifle and pretended to shoot me. I wonder if someday my kids will meet him in some distant battlefield. I pray to God that if I have a son, he never has to go to war. That would tear my heart out. I feel very bad for my family. I know that I am putting them through hell. Sometimes I feel guilty for not just studying abroad. If you get a chance, hug your mom for me. My mom is 9,000 miles and 6 months away. I would do anything to give her a hug right now. I miss her a lot. I can't speak for all, But for most of us, it seems that our biggest concern is not getting killed, but getting left behind. It feels that everyone back in the world is getting on with their lives, finishing school, getting jobs or internships, making friends, planning their future, and we are frozen in time. When I get back, friends will be gone, innocence will be lost, and things will have changed. I just want things to be the way they used to be. Stephen. Just for a brief background on me, I am a Vietnam veteran, was there in 70-71, flew helicopters for the Marine Corps. My daughter, as I told her, she was dumb, but she did the same thing her mother did. She married a Marine, too. He's an Iraq veteran, and he's retired now. Both of us came home relatively unscathed. The Snake's Revenge. When Jeremy Sutcliffe decapitated a poisonous rattler threatening his wife, he assumed that would be the end of his story. He was wrong. Before the incident, before his body became a battleground for competing poisons, and his story the subject of zoological curiosity, Jeremy Sutcliffe would actually like snakes. He found them beautiful, even. Besides, the tattooed 40-year-old wasn't someone who shied away from wild creatures. He was an avid outdoorsman who took every chance he could to camp and fish. That love of nature was part of the reason Jeremy and his wife, Jennifer Sutcliffe, 43, had recently moved to South Texas from Kansas. The place they'd bought on Lake Corpus Christi, a short drive from the Gulf of Mexico, was their dream home, or it was going to be. At the moment, they were living in a trailer on their one-acre lot, and the house was still a fixer-upper. A total gut job, Jeremy called it, with the pride of someone who plans on doing the gutting himself. On a steamy Sunday morning in May 2018, the couple were tidying their yard in preparation for an evening cookout with their daughter and her two young children. At around 10:30 a.m., Jeremy began moving the lawn while Jennifer worked on the garden. She had just reached down to grab a weed when she saw it, a western diamondback rattlesnake, right next to her hand. Jennifer leaped up as the snake, a yard long, rose into strike position. Its dusty triangular head tensed and its tail rattling. "Snake!" yelled Jennifer as she backed away. "Snake!" When he heard his wife cry, Jeremy figured she had run into one of the harmless rat snakes that often showed up on the property. He grabbed a shovel and to shoo the creature away and jogged around the house to the garden. That was when he heard the rattling. His wife was cornered between some shrubbery and the house, the snake directly in her path. Jeremy first tried to scoop up the rattle using a shovel without success. Then he did what was necessary. He raised the garden tool and brought the edge down hard through the snake's body, an inch and a half below the head, decapitating it. Jennifer went into the house, her heart hammering, while Jeremy headed back to mowing. About 10 minutes later, when Jennifer said she was going to let their two small dogs out, he decided to move the dead reptile. He looked at a creature lying limp on the ground, its head attached to a stub of a body, rested on a paving stone. And there's a picture of Jeremy and his wife. He's almost as bald as me. He doesn't have much hair on the top of his head. Good-looking young man, and his wife is very attractive, blue eyes, long brown hair. He bent down to pick up a stick lying next to the snake's head so that he could flick it away. But before his hand even touched the ground, the snake attacked. A blur of motion as the creature launched itself forward, burying its fangs in Jeremy's right hand all the way down to the bone. The snake injected venom that immediately made his hand feel as if it had been smashed by a massive weight. "It bit me!" he yelled in horror. For Jeremy, it was like something out of a zombie movie, an undead creature's final act of revenge. But the truth is, these back home from the dead bites aren't uncommon. A decapitated snake is like a chicken with its head cut off, only with a much longer survival time because it's a cold-blooded reptile with a slow metabolism. In that moment, however, all Jeremy was thinking about was that the snake he'd killed was now trying to kill him. The creature's jaws were clamped around his hand. Desperate to free himself, Jeremy inserted the finger of his left hand beneath the snake's upper jaw and tried to pry the fangs free. He managed to remove one of the fangs from his middle finger, but as he tried to pull the head loose, the viper's jaws clenched again, burying the fang in his ring finger this time. At the sound of his cry, Jennifer, a trained nurse, could come running. When she saw her husband struggling with the rattlesnake's head, one thought flashed through her mind. He needs medical attention. Now! She ran back into the trailer to get the car keys, while Jeremy continued to yank at the snake's head until finally the fangs came loose and he could fling the viper away. Jennifer told her husband to get in the car. She drove out on the broiling Texas asphalt, already on the phone with a 911 dispatcher. They were more than a half hour away from the nearest hospital, and Jennifer had no idea which of the medical centers in the area had venom. All she knew was that they didn't have much time. Jennifer had always been unflappable under pressure. In Texas, she was a nurse consultant, but back when she'd worked in hospitals, she'd been the go-to person for CPR, someone colleagues would turn to when competence and quick thinking could be the difference between life and death. She'd known her husband for their entire adult life. They met in the summer of 1993 when they were both students working at a nursing home. She liked his sparkling blue eyes and the fact that he was kind. The two became friends, then more. They were married a couple years later and went on to have a son and a daughter. Jeremy was handy, a builder and a tinker who worked installing heating and air conditioning. He always seemed to be helping out one neighbor or another. In 2011, at age 34, Jeremy was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare and mysterious condition that causes the immune system to attack healthy nerve cells. The disease left Jeremy weak and exhausted, unable to work more than a few hours a day. But the couple got through it together. When they bought the house in Corpus Christi, it felt like the ideal situation. While she worked, he would slowly create their dream home. Now, as Jennifer sped down the highway, she could feel that fantasy slipping away. On the phone, the 911 dispatcher was directing her to a spot where an ambulance would meet them to bring her husband to the nearest hospital. Mere minutes after being bitten, however, Jeremy was already feeling the effects of the venom coursing through his body. When he blinked, he saw nothing but blackness. "I can't see," he said, panic in his voice, before passing out. Jennifer shook her husband with one hand while keeping the other on the wheel. Jeremy woke up only to pass out again. Then he began having a seizure. The 911 operator told Jennifer to pull over and wait in front of the church for paramedics. Finally, after the longest 15 minutes of her life, during which Jeremy alternated between babbling incoherently and losing consciousness, the paramedics arrived. They transferred Jeremy to the ambulance and raced down the highway with Jennifer close behind. After just 10 minutes, the ambulance pulled over into the parking lot of an abandoned building. When Jennifer pulled up, the paramedics told her that her husband was in bad shape. His blood pressure had plummeted, and they were worried he wasn't going to make it to the hospital. Still half an hour away. Instead of driving, they were sending for a helicopter that would get him to a different emergency room in 10 minutes. Moments later, the chopper touched down and whisked Jeremy away. Rattlesnake venom is a miracle of evolution, a complex cocktail of enzymes and proteins that, when injected into a victim's bloodstream, acts like a powerful blood thinner, destroying skin tissue and blood cells and causing internal hemorrhaging. A rattlesnake's fangs are connected to venom glands at the back of its head. Snakes control how much venom they inject, and because producing venom takes energy, they typically don't want to waste it. When cornered, an adult rattlesnake will usually deliver a light defensive strike to scare off a threat. A snake that has been decapitated, however, has nothing to lose, so the snake that bit Jeremy emptied its venom glands into his hand. When Jennifer got to the emergency department at Christian Spohn Hospital, Corpus Christi Shoreline, about an hour and 15 minutes after Jeremy did, she found a hectic scene. There were six or seven doctors working on her husband, desperately trying to get his blood pressure up. Just 2 hours after being bitten, his right hand was enormous and swollen, an angry red creeping up his forearm. She watched with her nurse's eyes as the doctors gave him a host of treatments, cyproprecipitate and vitamin K to clot the blood, and dose after dose of antivenom. The average snake bite victim is given 2 to 4 doses of antivenom. In total, Jeremy received 26. Jennifer knew IVs. If a patient needed fluid quickly, you simply increased the flow, turning a drip into a steady trickle. But the doctors had put an IV bag in an inflatable sleeve that they pumped up like a blood pressure cuff, literally squeezing fluid into her husband's body as fast as they could. She'd never seen anything like it before. The sight terrified her. At 5 p.m., after 5 hours of working on Jeremy, the doctors came to a decision. His organs were failing. They needed to induce a coma and put him on a ventilator. Jennifer numbly agreed. At around 3 a.m., one of the doctors approached her. Her husband wasn't doing well. His blood pressure was still dangerously low. The mean arterial pressure, MAP, that doctors were looking at was 65. Anything lower and the heart can't push blood through the body. They had Jeremy on the maximum doses of 4 medications designed to increase his blood pressure, but his MAP refused to budge above 60. "We're at the point where there's nothing else we can do," the doctor said. There was a good chance Jeremy wouldn't make it through the night. Jennifer felt her heart plummet. She hadn't registered the gravity of the situation somehow. She went to her husband's bedside, grabbed his hand. "You find that venom and you push it out of your body," she ordered. "You can't die." Over the next half hour, she stood by her husband's side in the ICU, her eyes glued to the monitor next to his bed. Slowly, miraculously, Jeremy's blood pressure ticked up as she watched. It made it to 65, then 70. The doctors began taking him off the medication as the pressure remained stable. By some following day, the worst was over. On May 31st, 5 days after the rattlesnake that he killed nearly killed him, Jerry emerged from his coma and found himself in a strange hospital room. His mind was foggy. His entire body was swollen with more than 40 pounds of water weight. Pain radiated from his legs, his arms, and his bowels, everywhere. But as he looked around, he saw that he was surrounded by his family, his daughter and her children, his son, Jennifer. The next weeks were difficult. The mixture of venom and antivenom had caused severe kidney damage, and Jeremy needed dialysis. The toxins had left him with gallstones, kidney stones, and fierce abdominal pain. He was so weak he couldn't stand. The medical expenses piled up close to $60,000. So the couple started a GoFundMe page to help pay for the battery of treatments. The fingers of Jeremy's right hand were badly wounded. The doctors tried skin graft but were unsuccessful. In the end, they were forced to amputate his ring and middle finger. For anyone else, the loss of two fingers... Sorry about that. My computer just had a glitch. For anyone else, the loss of two fingers would be devastating. But Jeremy didn't see it that way. After getting a glimpse of the worst, he was feeling positive. About a month after the bite, his kidneys were working well enough for doctors to take him off dialysis. "I'd trade a couple of fingers for my kidneys coming back," he said. Lying in the hospital bed... I'm really having difficulty with the computer this morning. Sorry about that. Lying in a hospital bed, slowly recovering, he had time to think. When I first came to and things were all right, I'd cry a lot and think about all the dumb things I'd done, the people I'd hurt, Jeremy says. He remembers skipping his kids' events or ignoring Jennifer while he was off working on a neighbor's house. It wasn't that he'd done anything terrible, just that his new perspective suddenly made it everything misstep seem like a tragic waste. The experience had changed him. "The things that used to matter didn't feel like they matter so much," he says. "My wife and my family seem so much more important now." In late June 2018, Jeremy was released from the hospital and the couple moved back to their dream home in Progress. And one evening in July, they finally had the cookout they'd been planning. Their daughter and grandchildren came over, as did a neighbor. Everyone sat in the garden eating hamburgers, grilled corn, and potatoes and enjoying the warm Texas air. The settlers paused to take it all in. This was their paradise. And no snake could change that. And there's a picture not only of Jeremy in a recliner in dialysis, but also the body of the actual head of the snake, just the head. She's not exactly extra sharp. Myleaf in Vancouver, Washington, had been diligently washing her hands to avoid COVID-19, only to find that her cleaning agent was largely worthless, unless she wanted to make a sandwich. Turns out she'd been scrubbing with an old piece of Tillamook cheddar cheese. It was a couple days of, "Why isn't this foaming?" she wrote on her Reddit.com. "I suspect I left it out when I was intoxicated and just forgot." And with that, let's switch over to the Consumer Reports. And I'm going to read this. We're almost out of time for this, but I'm going to read it anyway. If you're concerned that the COVID-19 pandemic will make voting in November election difficult, rest assured that you can cast your ballot and stay safe. Whether you choose to vote by mail, i.e. vote an absentee ballot, vote early in person, or vote in person on election day. First, check your voter registration status. Do this even if you're already registered or have never had any trouble voting in the past. Some states have purged their voter rolls, and many of the ways that voters ordinarily register at the DMV or at registration drives aren't available because of the COVID-19 crisis. Go to nass.org/can-i-vote. This is the best single source of links to state-by-state voter registration tools and information. It's all the first thing that comes up if you type "Can I Vote?" into the Google search engine. Click on Register to Vote or Voter Registration Status to choose your state for instructions. Mail-in or absentee ballot voting. Mail-in voting, by its nature, is the surest way to avoid long lines and minimum potential exposure to COVID-19. One expert we spoke with estimates that at least 50% of the votes cast in November will be by mail-in ballot. The rules and restrictions for mail-in voting vary by state, but there's no state where you can't vote by mail. To request a mail-in ballot and check state rules, go to the state absentee voting link at the NASS. Can I Vote page. Closely monitor deadlines and follow instructions, which unfortunately when this is read will probably be past that time. But early in-person voting will still be available for at least two or three more days. Early voting, now available in about 40 states, is usually an effective way to avoid the crowds and long lines at polling stations on Election Day. And this can also reduce your risk of contracting the virus. You can check your own state's early voting rules through the NASS Can I Vote page. Voting on Election Day. If you're planning to vote in person, you could face long lines due to social distancing and or reduced polling locations and staff shortages. If you can, try to show up during off-peak times, such as the middle of the day. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends all voters wear a mask, maintain at least 6 feet of social distance, use hand sanitizer often, especially after touching surfaces such as doorknobs and voting machines, not to mention pens, and wash your hands carefully afterward. Avoid spending much time at the polling place by verifying your vote info and having all registration forms ready. Bring a black pen and a stylus for electronic voting machines and review a sample ballot in advance at ballotready.org so that you can vote and depart quickly. For more voting information and tips, go to cr.org/vote1120. And the Ask Our Experts section. Ergonomics experts now say that switching back and forth, is it really healthier to stand at my desk all day rather than sitting? Ergonomics experts now say that switching back and forth between sitting and standing is your best option. The main benefit of a standing desk is the ability to move, says Dinah Kieber, CR's in-house ergonomics expert. But aim for 10 minutes of standing and moving every half hour. To facilitate standing, you don't need to invest hundreds in a standing desk. A swing arm adapter, which clamps to the back of an existing desk or table with either a shelf for your laptop or a mount for your monitor, can be had for around $100. Just make sure you can lift high enough so that your screen is at eye level, or use your laptop on a kitchen counter for short periods, even if that means your laptop screen is at eye level. It's okay to stand at your breakfast bar or kitchen island for just 15 minutes as a way to change positions, says Todd Dacre, the lead ergonomics session consultant for Musculoskeletal Injury Prevention Program at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. My doctor gave me a prescription for what is called an off-label use. Is that safe? Legally, a doctor can prescribe a drug for conditions that the drug was not specifically approved for the Food and Drug Administration to treat. For example, neurotonin, generic name gabapentin, is approved to treat epileptic seizures, but is used off-label to treat nerve pain related to diabetes. In fact, going off-label is common between 12 and 38% of all prescriptions written in a doctor's office or for off-label uses. According to a 2019 Congressional Research Service report, though, it's illegal for a drug company to advertise off-label use. Only about a quarter of the off-label prescribing is supported by strong scientific research, which is why the practice can be controversial. Why would your doctor do this? A drug is sometimes thought to be useful in treating conditions beyond what it was approved for. Getting FDA's approval requires clinical trials to prove treatment for a specific condition. That can make years and often cost about $20 million per trial. So companies might not always seek approvals for additional conditions. An off-label prescription may make sense for you when no other available treatments works or when you're in a group that wasn't studied. For example, if a drug was approved for specific age range only, always ask your doctor whether a drug she's prescribing is approved for your condition and look up yourself at dailymed.nim.nih.gov, a governmental funded database. CR Insights, the ease of wireless chargers. Designed so that your smartphone simply rests on a pad or stand, wireless chargers allow users to forego the usual fumble of plugging in a charging cable. But is that convenience worth buying? Yet another tech accessory? Find out. We tested 6 wireless chargers. All are QI compatible. Q is pronounced Qi. Oh, that's interesting. A near-universal wireless charging standard that works with many smartphones and supports Samsung's fast charge technologies. Many of you have a recent high-end Samsung phone. They should provide even quicker charging. Our lab technicians evaluated how easy the chargers were to use. They also measured how long it took for each device to fully charge both an iPhone 11 Pro Max, and a Samsung Galaxy S10, both compatible with wireless charging, then averaged those times. Though there were some differences in charging speeds, all the products powered up the phones in a reasonable amount of time and didn't short out when sprayed with a small amount of water. Good to know if your charger lives on a kitchen counter. The fastest models by far is the Samsung's 15W stand. The benefits of a stand rather than a flat pad is that it's easier to see notifications on your phone while you charge it, and it features an LED light that makes it easier to see whether your phone is fully charged. But for a family, a multi-device charger, such as an Anker, which we'll show below, may be best. In our test, it charged two phones at once at the same amount of time as a single phone. Leading the charge, Samsung's 15 QI-certified post fast charge wireless charging stand for $60. And then there's a convenient for a nice price is the Samsung wireless charger pad, 9-watt, for $40. And there's also two phones at once charging, the Anker PowerWave 10-watt charger at $50. And the long warranty up to 3 years, Belkin Boost Up wireless charging pad 10W, also for $40. CR Insights continues. How to clean practically anything. How to remove tough mattress stains. These days, your bedroom may be doubling as an office or a quiet hideaway to stream your favorite show. But balancing your laptop in bed makes it all the more likely you'll drop food bits, drip a little coffee, or spill some wine. Generally, you can treat mattresses similar to spot treating carpet, says Mary Benoga Johnson, principal scientist at Tide and Downey at P&G Fabric Care. Johnson says that if you have to attack the stain immediately, and be prepared to treat and repeat multiple times until the stain is gone. To handle a fresh spill, remove the bedding for washing, then gently blot the stain with a clean cloth to soak up any excess liquid on the mattress. Next, dab liquid detergent directly onto the mattress stain. For optimal stain removal, use a top-rated detergent from our tests. The Tide and Persil detergents at Wright, and I'll show those in a minute, both earn excellent ratings for presenting penetrating stains. Sorry about that. You can also use a stain remove spray directly on your mattress, such as OxiClean Max 4 Spray, which rates excellent in our tests for tracking salad dressing stains as well as body oil and dirt, or OxiClean Laundry Stain Remover Spray, which works particularly well on coffee stains compared with other stain removing sprays we tested. If you spill red wine, one of the toughest stains to get out, experts advise a homemade remedy. Blot the stain with a cloth dampened with cold water, then mix one part dish soap and two parts hydrogen peroxide, and pour it into a damp cloth that you can use to blot the stain again. Repeat until the stain fades away. Dealing with old dry stains? Try an upholstery cleaner, an enzyme-based pet odor remover, or a simple solution, 1 teaspoon mild dish detergent and 1 cup of warm water. And the odd things are Tide Plus Ultra Stain Release at 28 cents per load. It rates an 84 score. And then Persil Clean Stain Fighter. That's only 21 cents a load. And that's got an 84 as well. Time Traveler on Toiletries. And these are always interesting. In 1920, Listerine mouthwash, originally used as an antiseptic for surgeries, uses the words halitosis to describe bad breath for the first time. That's it. I guess bad breath didn't exist before 1920. Yeah, right. 1939, we rate 100 brands of soap and find that one of the cheapest, a colossal soap bar for 3 cents, is also one of the highest quality. Despite marketing hype, there's no need to splurge on pricey soap, see our experts say. In 1949, we test 93 brands of toothpaste and powders and reveal that some are harmful. 12 brands contain enough particles hard enough to scratch glass. 1959, one of the first electric toothbrushes to hit the U.S. market is called the Broxodent. It is claimed to brush up to and down 120 times per second. 1975, after founding Tom's in Maine in 1970, Tom Chappelle and his wife bring the first natural toothpaste to the U.S. market. In 1984, we test the Italian folding razor for campers. It folds into the size of a matchbook. The design is ingenious, we say, but the shave quality is really subpar. In 1993, a can of Barbasol shaving cream is a prominent plot point in Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park. though in the Michael Crichton novel, it's a Gillette can. Product placement. 2010, CR staffers test 10 electric toothbrushes before and after brushing. A dentist uses dye to reveal plaque, and the priciest ones remove the most. In 2016, shaving clubs offer a new way to buy razors for less. We test razors from three clubs and judging how close the shave is. Gillette is the favorite. In 2020, in our most recent test of electric toothbrushes, a Sonicare model is among the top rated for excellent cleaning and performance. The Philips Sonicare Clean is 100 to 6100 for $110. Okay, here's something interesting. I had to replace one recently myself. A toaster oven earns its spot on the coaster for being able to do a lot more than turn out toast. It can broil burgers, roast asparagus, or bake cookies. I turn to countertop holiday helpers. Plus, our survey suggests that this kitchen staple may last longer than you expect. 90% of the 27,200 toaster ovens that CR members purchased between 2011 and 2019 were still being used in 2019. Actually, mine was purchased in 2002 and lasted until this year. And where only 5% were replaced due to reliability problems. But reliability differs widely among brands. In fact, only three receive an excellent rating for predicted reliability, which estimates the likelihood that newly purchased toasters ovens from a given brand will develop problems or break within the first 4 years. And two brands, DeLong and Farberware, earn such low reliability ratings that we can't recommend them at this time. A tip from our members, in addition to reliability, look for a model that our tests show is easy to clean. Difficulty cleaning was responsible biggest complaint about toaster ovens. And the top-ranked toaster ovens was Panasonic, Breville, and Oster. Mine's an Oster. Cuisinart got fairly high ranks, Black & Decker, Cephalon, and my previous one was Black & Decker, and it lasted a long time. Cephalon, Hamilton Beach, KitchenAid, Woof, Bella, Crux, and Krupps lasted. Those all got pretty good ratings. Best blood pressure monitors for $50 or less. Roughly one of every three U.S. adults reports having high blood pressure, according to a recent study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Some research, however, suggests that the true number of Americans with hypertension could be closer to 45%, and only a quarter have it controlled. A level of 130 to 80 is considered stage 1 hypertension. Hypertension affects different racial and ethnic groups equally in the U.S. among adults, 40% of blacks, 30% of American Indian and Alaska Natives, and 30% of Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders report having hypertension, compared with 29% of whites, 28% of Hispanics, and about 24% of Asians. The CDC study says some research, however, found that Asians have a greater odds of having hypertension than whites, and another study found that Hispanic and black people have hypertension with hypertension are less likely than non-Hispanic whites to have it under control. The reasons may include lack of quality insurance coverage. A good plan for those with high blood pressure includes regular exercise, a healthy diet, and for some, medications. Research suggests that self-monitoring may be beneficial, too. In some cases, a home blood pressure monitor, which can range from $20 to $100, may help diagnose hypertension, because levels recorded at the doctor may differ from those in everyday life. But will a cheaper drugstore model work well? Our home monitor test, which evaluate accuracy, comfort, and ease of use, found budget monitors that get the job done, so CR testing lead Susan Booth. The models below even outperform some $90 and $100 models we tested. Okay, helpful features and easy to use is the Omron Silver BP5250 from Amazon, $50. And its overall score was 85, accuracy was excellent, convenience was excellent, and comfort was okay. Stores, multiple user profiles, A&D Medical UA76XF for $45. Overall score was an 81, accuracy was excellent, convenience and comfort were good. Accurate but less comfy, Rite Aid Deluxe Automatic BP3AR1, 4D Rite, $37. Overall score was 80, accuracy was excellent, convenience was okay, and comfort was just fair. Bargain price, Equate 4000 series at Walmart, $29. Overall score was 75, Accuracy, convenience, and comfort were all good, but not excellent. Your snooping smart speaker. Do you ever worry that the microphone in your smart speaker is listening to your conversations in your home when it's not supposed to? You're right to be concerned. According to a recently released study, using dialogue from popular TV shows, researchers at Northeastern University have discovered that smart speakers are often fooled into recording you when they hear words that sound similar to a speaker's wake words. Those designed to summon a smart speaker's digital assistant such as, "Hey Alexa," to engage Amazon's Alexa. Researchers noted when the devices started recording and for how long, as well as what dialogue triggered the device. For example, the Google Home Mini mistook the phrase "OK to go" for its wake words, "Hey Google," and the Apple HomePod heard "Hey Missy" as "Hey Siri." Researchers also noted that high frequency of false activation occurred during episodes of Narcos with Spanish dialogue. On average, the speakers had one activation every 4 hours. However, the study also found that smart speakers tend to catch their mistakes quickly and shut off the mic, normally within seconds. Digital assistants are an imperfect technology, says Justin Brookman, Director of Privacy and Technology Policy. While we bring these devices into our houses, the risk we take, there's no telling how they're using it to better understand us. Recalls, safety recalls, Honda vehicles. Honda has announced two software-related recalls. The first recall involves the software that controls the backup camera display on 499,342 vehicles, including the 2019-2020 Odyssey minivans, 2019-2020 Passport SUVs, and 2000-2021 Pilot SUVs. The display may be destroyed or fail to show when the vehicle is put in reverse, increasing the risk of a crash. Consequently, these vehicles fail to comply with federal safety standards. The other recall of 607,784 vehicles is to address concerns with the instrument panel software. Incorrect software can mean that the panel will fail to display the key information such as engine oil pressure, speedometer, and gear selector position until the vehicle is turned off and restarted. The vehicles and model years are the same as this recall as the backup camera recall, with the addition of the 2018 Odyssey. Look for a mail notification that comes late September 2020. Honda dealerships will update appropriate software at no charge. Boy Scouts of America pens. This is interesting. Boy Scouts of America is recalling about 78,000 Cub Scout activity pens because the pen's face and shaft contain levels of lead that exceed the federal lead content ban. Lead is toxic if ingested by young children and can cause adverse health issues. The pens were sold by Boy Scouts of America retail stores and authorized distributors nationwide and online at scoutshop.org from April 2016 through January 2020 for about $1. What to do? Take the pen away from kids and return it to any Boy Scouts of America retail store or contact Boy Scouts of America National Distribution Center for a full refund, including shipping, or for a merchandise credit. Go to scoutshop.org for details. A step forward for infant safety. After a Consumer Reports investigation prompted the recall of millions of infant-inclined sleepers and help pod lead, helped lead to a proposed ban of the products by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, CR has reached another milestone for safe infant sleep. CR found evidence that another type of baby product, known as the in-bed sleeper, meant for bed sharing with a caregiver, was linked to at least 12 infant deaths. In the wake of CR's efforts, staffers for CPSC sent a letter to juvenile product industry representatives emphasizing their serious concerns with the product. CR welcomes the move and continues to urge parents to stop using any product that doesn't meet federal safety requirements related to infant sleep, including the bed sleepers. The products, which are largely unregulated, feature padding that can block a baby's ability to breathe and soft sidewalls that don't prevent the parents from rolling onto a sleeper and the baby. And by their nature, they encourage bed sharing, a practice that itself increases the risk of infant death. For more details on the investigation, go to cr.org/safebaby1020. Honda ROVs. Honda's recalling about 25,000 ROVs because they can move or roll when the park position poses passing crash and injury hazards. The ROVs were sold at authorized Honda Power Sports dealers nationwide November 2018 through March 2020 for $15,000 to $24,000. Stop using the ROV and contact an authorized Honda dealership to make an appointment for a free inspection and repair. Costway strollers. Costway is recalling about 16,000 double baby strollers because they violate the federal standard for carriages and strollers. A child's torso can pass through the opening between the tray and the seat bottom, and his or her head can become trapped, posing strangulation hazards. There's also a large opening between the seat and the crotch restraint, posing a fall hazard. The strollers were sold online at Costway.com and Amazon from May 2016 to December 2019 for about $100. What to do? Stop using the stroller and contact Costway at 844-242-1885 for details on how to receive a full refund, including taxes and shipping. Quick Brewing Coffee Makers. Our testers recognize the importance of speed when it comes to brewing a fresh pot, especially if you have lots of coffee drinkers at home. We time how long it takes to drip coffee to makers to brew a pot of coffee, 40 ounces or about 8 coffee cups, says Jenny Liu, one of CR's test engineers. And for the pod machines, we time how long it takes to brew the first cup, then subsequent cups. The picks here are some of the speediest models we tested and also earned top overall scores for coffee brewing. Fastest single serve is an Espresso Pixie espresso maker for $200, 91 score, that's a high score. Fastest drip machine is the Ninja Hot and Cold Brew System for $230, that got a 73. And the fastest grind and brew machines, Cusinar Next Generation Brewer Grind and Brew Cup, 12 cup, $180. Too much. How to spot misinformation online. If you're a person who thinks they can spot misinformation just by looking at it, you're at risk of being fooled, says Mike Caulfield, a digital literacy expert at Washington State University, Vancouver. That's actually the trap. Misinformation, ranging from unfound political conspiracy theories to bad info about COVID-19, can spread quickly on social media platforms where Americans increasingly get their news and information. What's worse is the rules about misinformation on social media are confusing and inconsistent, and enforcement of these policies is slipshod at best, says Bill Fitzgerald, a privacy and technology researcher at CR's Digital Lab. This murkiness allows misinformation to flourish and makes it hard to know what expert on each platform and to choose where to go for important information. Fortunately, there are ways to sort fact from fiction. In 2019, Caulfield developed the SIFT method, S-I-F-T, a technique to defend against misinformation. Often people really rely solely on the authentic look and feel of a piece of media in order to gauge its reliability, he says. But you need to go deeper than that if you're trying to sniff out a social media post or online article with misinformation in it. The acronym, GIFT, will help you just that. There are four steps that the word represents. It's designed with browsing the Internet in mind, though Caulfield says you can apply the stages to books you read or things you see on TV. Plus, putting SIFT into action takes only about 90 seconds, Caulfield says. And here's the explanation for SIFT. Stop if something you read or see triggers a strong emotion for you, such as surprise, anger, or sadness. Take a pause. Some post aims to elicit a strong emotional reaction in order to override your critical thinking. Investigate the source. Unfamiliar with the publication or writer in question? A quick search engine scan should help you uncover their reputation. Can't find anything at all about them? That's a big red flag. Find better coverage. In addition to the source, check the claim being made by seeing whether other news outlets are also reporting it and compare them. If something is important, multiple outlets will pick it up. Dramatic claims that you can't find elsewhere are suspicious. And trace claims, quotes, and media. Some of the most insidious misinformation simply takes the truth out of context. Click on source links you see in online articles or paste in an automotive quote or soundbite into a search engine to look for the further quote, fuller quote, or video. It may show you the missing contact. And they have a list here of which platforms allow false information, and it's coded, and I'll read these codes. So it's kind of distant. Political and social. Facebook is permitted. Instagram is permitted. Routine is permitted, is allowed. Twitter is allowed. Pinterest is sometimes. Reddit is allowed. Snapchat is sometimes restricted. WhatsApp is unrestricted. And TikTok is sometimes restricted. Health coronavirus things on Facebook is sometimes. Instagram, it's sometimes. YouTube, it's sometimes. Twitter, it's sometimes. And Pinterest is completely prohibited. Reddit, it's sometimes. Snapchat, it's prohibited. WhatsApp, it's sometimes, it's allowed. And TikTok, it's prohibited. Voting census information on Facebook is forbidden. Instagram's forbidden. YouTube is forbidden. Twitter is forbidden. And Pinterest is forbidden. Reddit allows it. Snapchat is forbidden. WhatsApp allows it. And TikTok is forbidden. By the way, WhatsApp, nothing is unprohibited. It's all allowed. And manipulated media on Facebook, if they find it, it's prohibited. Same for Instagram, it's prohibited. YouTube is sometimes allowed. Twitter is sometimes allowed. Pinterest and Reddit are both banned. Snapchat is banned. WhatsApp, once again, allows it all. And TikTok is also banned. And we're getting near a close here, so let's go ahead and read a couple of Laughter the Best Medicine. A psychiatrist and a proctologist opening a practice together. They put an ad in the local paper asking what the sign out front should read. Suggestions started rolling in. Minds and behinds. Catatonics and high colonics. Nuts and butts. Loons and moons. They finally settled on odds and ends. What do you call a tailor who only alters pants? A slacker. A rock band whose members can't stop washing their hands. OCDC. And lastly, a surprising wind instrument. A Pennsylvania man believes he had discovered the cause of extreme weather in his particular corner of the country. We didn't have tornadoes here until we started putting in the traffic circles, he says. You want to know why? When people go round and round in circles, it causes disturbance in the atmosphere and causes tornadoes, for sure. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.